The Long Emergency, a book by James Howard Kunstler, who is my guest right now. That Long Emergency being just about to begin. James, China, before we leave the subject of China, how likely is it, as you pointed out, they have a massive number of nuclear weapons, fully capable of really putting us in a mess if it got down to that. How likely is it that as the pinch gets really severe, we could end up in a conflict with China?
Well, that's a good question. And in fact, Robert Kaplan has a very interesting piece on that in the current Atlantic Monthly magazine, although I don't happen to agree with his view. Kaplan's view is that we're going to see a kind of renewed Cold War with a new Cold War partner, so to speak, and that all the action will be in the Pacific region. And I don't really see it that way at all. I actually see the world becoming a somewhat larger place. As we were talking before the break about whether the United States could indefinitely occupy these Middle Eastern nations to keep the Middle East stabilized, to sort of police the region. And my conclusion is that sooner or later, the U.S. is going to bankrupt itself or exhaust itself militarily just in that policing duty, and that sooner or later, we will have to withdraw into our hemisphere.
Well, the signs of that are there now.
Well, the signs of exhaustion are there.
Yes.
You know, you raised earlier the fact that the American public in polling seems to be wearying of the great adventure in Iraq.
No question.
And sooner or later, we may find ourselves not doing that. Now, when that happens, we are going to lose a lot of our ability to control events in that part of the world where we get so much oil. And sooner or later, we may actually lose our access to that oil. I really doubt that we are going to contest militarily in Asia or the Middle East with China, with the Chinese army on land. That would seem to be a project that we could feel very little confidence about.
Well, as something happens, old Taiwan would probably be just a perfect place for, you know, some sort of something to happen.
It would be, but you know, and there's every reason to believe that there's going to be mischief over Taiwan. But when you we have treaties with Taiwan that oblige us to protect them. But when you really get down to it,
would we?
Well, when you really get down to it, I wonder whether we would do a very quick reevaluation on what our true interests were. And I'm not sure that we have an enormous interest in keeping Taiwan as an independent entity from the greater Chinese nation itself. I can't see the U.S. getting into a nuclear exchange over that. So that remains to be seen. I differ from Kaplan. I think that I don't particularly see us being able to engage with China in the way he states. He believes that the Chinese Navy is being built up to form a rivalry with the United States Navy. But it raises the question, for control of what? Well, I think the answer is for control of the sea lanes where the oil is transported. And the Chinese want to make sure that they can defend those transportation routes. But, you know, oddly enough, we now have these very important economic relations with China, which involve this pipeline of manufactured goods, you know, of all the stuff that fills up the Walmart and the Kmart, which has been, you know, coming over to us and endlessly for the last 20 years. And so you wonder, under any scenario that has us coming into serious conflict with China, what happens to the U.S. retail economy? What do people think is going to happen with that?
Well, of course, that's a two-way street, too, though, James. And since they're producing all of these things and making a great deal of money from it, they might be loath to get into a conflict with their biggest market.
You're quite right. That's an excellent point. I think what we'll see happen, in fact, will be a bit different. As the oil markets wobble, and this brings us back to the United States, as the oil markets wobble, I think that all large entities in the United States, corporations, governments, even large agricultural systems, are going to find themselves in trouble. Really, anything large is going to be in trouble, anything that is done on a giant scale. And, you know, one of the easier ones to talk about is Walmart and the businesses like it, you know, the national chain retail system that we have devised for ourselves for carrying on trade in America, for retail trade. So we depend on these enormous systems, the Walmart warehouse on wheels where they're sending 18-wheel tractor trailers continually all over America with, you know, with all these plastic wading pools and mix masters and, you know, trucks full of women's clothing and plastic flip-flops and garden tools and all this stuff coming from China, being made in China, and it's going circulating continually around the United States until it lands in the Walmart in Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Right.
This is a system that is not going to prove to be very resilient, especially in the face of wobbling oil prices, fluctuating oil prices.
All right, this gets us, you wrote a lot about suburbia, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
All right, so what is it about suburbia? Explain that.
Well, how do we think about suburbia? You know, first of all, it's a living arrangement, and it's also an economy. It can also be viewed in sort of macroeconomic historic terms as, and this is how I would put it, the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world.
Pretty severe.
The greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. We poured all of our post-war wealth into building this infrastructure for daily life that has one outstanding characteristic, which is that it has no future. And the future is now here. And so you have to ask yourself, what is the destiny of this living arrangement we've created for ourselves?
Why does suburbia have no future?
Well, because it depends utterly on cheap and reliable supply, on reliable supplies of utterly cheap oil. And if you subtract that, then it becomes completely dysfunctional. And
the people who have commuted from suburbia into the city eventually will no longer be able to afford to do so. Is that it?
Well, that is going to be part of the picture. You know, we also have the problem that the dirty secret of the American economy for the last 20, 30 years is that it has come to be based mainly on the creation of ever more suburbia and the furnishing of it and the accessorizing of it and the servicing of it. And if you subtract all of that, you know, the home building and the tanning huts and the burger barns and the strip mall building and the automobiles and, you know, motoring around continually, and you subtract all that activity in motion from the American economy, there isn't a whole lot left besides open heart surgery and hair cutting. And so, you know, people ask me, why does the American leadership seem so clueless about this issue? Why aren't they preparing the American public for this post-cheap oil future?
How would they do that?
Well, here's the problem. Well, first, let me answer my own question, my own rhetorical question. The reason that we're being so poorly prepared is that nobody wants to touch this issue about what the American economy really is, and the fact that it's utterly dependent on this chain of suburban activities, the building of ever more tract houses, you know, the building of ever more strip malls and big box stores, and sooner or later we're going to bump up against some very uncomfortable limits. We already are. One of them is that the middle class in America has been struggling for a while to keep their incomes up, keep their wages up. In fact, it's been a losing battle. And a great deal of the retail action for the last 10 years has simply been people giving their credit cards a workout, and we know where that leads.
Yes.
And we know that that has to stop sooner or later. So the reason we don't hear about this from our leaders is that they're terrified that if this game of musical chairs stops with the suburban economy and the economy based on building suburban houses, that there won't be a whole lot left. And that means, you know, a lot of unemployed people and a lot of angry unemployed people who are going to be bewildered about the loss of their entitlement to the American dream.
So the destiny of suburbia?
The destiny of suburbia is to become dysfunctional, to lose value. A lot of the presumed wealth in America exists in the form of suburban real estate. That presumed wealth is going to evaporate. It will prove to have been a temporary hallucination.
And so the necessity driven by energy shortages will be to get people close together again, the city life.
That's one way of looking at it, but I wouldn't put it quite that way. There are other options. And you have to sort of look at other activities to see where this is going.
Like, other options like what?
Well, for one thing, we may not, you know, big cities are going to be in as much trouble as suburbia. Especially the biggest ones, places like Chicago, New York, L.A., New York and Chicago especially being overburdened with exactly the kinds of skyscrapers and large buildings that we're going to have trouble with in a post-cheap energy economy. But getting back to my point, you have to look, for example, to the problems that we will encounter in agriculture when the cheap oil economy starts to falter.
Okay.
You know, we produce all the food for our nation, in essence, by pouring oil on the soils of the Midwest and pouring fertilizers made out of natural gas on the soils of the Midwest. And
correct.
So we have this agriculture, you know, based on large corporate entities producing cheese doodles and Pepsi-Cola for the American diet. And that is not something that is going to continue for very long. And we are going to get in severe trouble with food production. The upshot of it all is that probably within the next 20 years, we're going to have to be producing a lot more of our food locally and in a different way, in a smaller scale, probably using a lot more human labor. I think there will be a lot of turbulent movement of people away from suburbia, and even away from our largest cities.
And all of this, you think, is driven by the coming energy shortage?
Yes, I think that the basic equation of the basic household economy of the American household writ large is going to be changing severely. It's going to require us to live very, very differently. So, you know, you said, will people move from this dysfunctional suburbia into the cities?
Yes.
I think we will see more likely that they will be moving into smaller towns and smaller cities, and the most successful places will be those places that have a viable agricultural hinterland near them, you know, an opportunity to grow food locally. And this, of course, has implications for certain parts of the country,
well,
including the one that you're in.
Yeah, the implication of what you're saying is that no longer will it be viable to be delivering the groceries to suburbia, basically, right?
Yeah, basically. The age of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad is coming to an end. We're going to have to make other arrangements. But, you know, we're also going to have tremendous problems with employment as vocational niches disappear and whole industries begin to wither. And a lot of those people, I think, are going to find themselves one way or another, sooner or later, redirected into agriculture, which I believe will come much more to the center, return back to the center of American life. It's a picture that I think is very hard for the average citizen to comprehend. And yet I think that's exactly where we're heading.
How quickly, James, can you give the American people some idea of how soon it will start to become that severe?
Well, in my opinion, we will be seeing a lot of pressure on our way of life within the next 36 months. and I think we will be seeing we will be seeing a lot of turbulence within the end of the decade that we're in now.
Very soon is your
We'll see a lot of economic turbulence, a lot of population movement, a lot of jobs and industries changing and withering. I think national chain retail, Walmart and Target, et cetera, will be on the ropes within the next 10 years. and we're going to see American society being compelled to reorganize itself. And it's going to be very painful. And we're going to see a certain amount of hardship. There will be a lot of economic losers created by this process.
Does it become not reasonable any longer at some point in this emergency to be importing things from China and from other parts of the world?
Well, you know, circumstances will really dictate what happens with that. It certainly depends how long we can maintain the kind of friendly trade relations that we have. People assume that globalism is a permanent institution, when in fact it's really just the product of a kind of transitory period of certain conditions, a certain growth medium. There was a wonderful article in the magazine Foreign Affairs about a month or two ago by Neil Ferguson, the young historian at Harvard. And he was describing the first period of globalism that began in the 19th century, just after the Franco-Prussian War, around 1870, and continued until 1914. And, you know, this is this wonderful era of the late 19th century, turn of the century, sometimes known as the Belle Époque, the beautiful era. It was part of the progressive era in the United States, this era of tremendous prosperity and technological innovation, you know, all these wonderful things being invented, the car, the railroad, the telephone, motion pictures, phonographs, airplanes, you know, you name it. And tremendous global trade going on in this 45-year period. And then it all comes to an end with World War I and this tremendous calamity. And it isn't really resumed again until the 1960s or 70s when, you know, after a Second World War, those nations involved begin to recover and globalism resumes. So we're in kind of the second phase of globalism.
And you're suggesting that globalism will begin to go the other way. It'll begin to shrink as the ability for easy global movement grounds to a halt. That's really what you're saying, right?
Yeah, I think that that's basically it, that a lot of the procedures that are associated with globalism will wither. And we're already seeing some of them. You know, you could call the aviation industry the canary in the coal mine, so to speak.
Well, it's on its little skinny knees right now.
The aviation industry is on its knees, and things really haven't even gotten that bad yet. You know, they still have a lot of customers. We haven't even gotten to the point in America where the middle class is being really severely stressed.
That's a good point. Hold it right there. No question about what the airlines are going through. Ask anybody who works for the airlines. They really are in trouble. From the